From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll explore how some Wisconsinites are advocating for workers' rights. Then, we'll learn about the anti-Chinese riots that took place in Milwaukee in the late 1800s.
It was a case of white Milwaukeeans taking the law into their own hands, and I guess acting in the shadow of the Chinese exclusion system, and feeling that these local Chinese in Milwaukee had to be disciplined.
Plus, we'll tell you about a job listing that went viral last summer that lets you eat cheese for a living.
Cheese just has a kind of sort of comforting presence, and the thought of being paid to taste cheese all day. There was definitely some people very passionate and enthusiastic.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Ticks are a reality in Wisconsin for those who like to spend time outdoors. Later in the show, we'll learn how to do a proper tick check. But we'll start with this. It's May 1st, also known as May Day or International Workers' Day, a celebration of workers and the impact and gains they've had on shaping our working lives. In Wisconsin, that fight is ongoing. Today, we're sharing two stories from workers advocating for labor rights. We'll hear from Israel Pena, an immigrant worker from Green Bay, who was briefly fired after organizing workers at his job. But first, we'll hear from Stephanie Lohman, a nurse at Milwaukee's VA and vice president of WFNHP Local 5000, the Milwaukee Nurses chapter.
When I first graduated from university, I got a job and I thought, wow, if I work really hard, I could move up and maybe even be a supervisor or a manager and have a job that paid well and I would have good work-life balance. You know, I kind of did that for a while. Then I realized that it really wasn't what I thought it was. It wasn't work. The hardest workers didn't get paid the most. More and more, I just saw that the people who were working the hardest were actually getting paid the least. The real awakening was I went to Canada with my partner, and he was studying in a university that centered kind of like alternative ways of thinking about labor. And I would listen to a lot of what he was studying, but at the same time, I was studying my own nursing books and career. So I worked in Canada. We had a very strong nursing union, about 235,000 members, second only to like some of the auto workers. And so they had a lot of power in Canada. And I honestly didn't even notice the union really existed. And we never worked short and we never had mandatory overtime. And it was an awesome job. And then I came back to the United States and it was the exact opposite. A patient got onto a unit with a loaded gun. And I thought, wow, this is what they're talking about. This person could have come here and, you know, shot and killed workers and patients and families. And I went and I thought, well, surely management will want to do something about this. And when I went to management, they didn't. They said, well, what did you do wrong? I started to think about how we needed a union. And I reached out to a local union organizer. I just went on the internet. I didn't know anybody. And it quickly became clear that I was in way over my head, right? Organizing a union is a lot of work. And management really puts a lot of their resources, which means money, into opposing any efforts to take some of their power and give it to the workers. I felt so unsafe in that workplace that I thought, if I'm dead, I can do nothing. So I left and I thought the only place that I'm going to go work is somewhere with a union. So I applied and got a job at the Milwaukee VA. And there was one person left. So one person fighting for all 918 members of the bargaining unit. And he was working on a COVID unit. So burned out was like what he was in the beginning, and he was just like a crispy, fried version of himself. And I thought, well, I'm going to help. And he said, well, great. Well, then you're the vice president. When I started talking about the union on the unit where I was working, a lot of people were skeptical about what power the union even had. And That's true, because we work for the federal government, so we don't have the right to strike, and we don't have the right to negotiate for wages. And that's surprising for many people to learn. Federal unions are kind of overseen by a completely separate body than private sector unions, and we have a lot less rights to take concerted actions. So one thing that I do is I try to get rid of the lines that divide us. Our working conditions are what unite us, and I just try to talk to people about that, and we have been able to kind of effectively breathe life back into our union by engaging people in their material conditions. So talking only about what's going on at work, how does that impacts our ability to give veterans care. And the people that I found most engaged are people who care most about the mission, which is we are here to provide health care to veterans who earned it with their service. The nurses face the same issues that we all face, which is a speed up, right? So we all think of a speed up in terms of a factory line, but for nurses, it's doing more with less. So taking one more patient, you know, having one less support staff, working longer hours. At our VA, we have experienced a lot of this too. And just this week, we learned that they're going to be cutting 180 jobs at our VA. During the pandemic, everybody was celebrated as heroes, and the saying is heroes to zeros. We're back to the expendable workforce. Our time isn't honored. For instance, we earn 5 weeks of vacation annually, but they're only legally required to give us 4 weeks. So people are struggling to get time off. There's no rest. And what we see generally across healthcare is that the patients are sicker, and this is only going to get worse. And so nurses fear this, doctors fear this, respiratory therapists, OT, PT, we all see the classic speed up. And for what? You know, we all know where that leads us, which is somebody has to make money somewhere, and the VA is no exception. So we're really struggling, and I think that has also helped to bring people to the labor movement, because they see that voting for this person or that person hasn't led to an easement in any of this. Solidarity isn't a word, it's an action. We're seeing this more and more now in many places in our communities where we're seeing protests about war and famine and water rights and everything, is that sometimes if you want to drive change, you have to put something on the line. It's not just showing up when it's convenient. It's showing up when it's hard. I know that I could get fired, right? I can be fired because people target the union, and that seems like a thing of the past, but it happens now. And in solidarity, we pick each other up too. So we all have to be able to stick our neck out a little bit for people who are needing it, so that when our turn comes to need it, we deserve it. And that's kind of the question that I leave everyone with, is how can you show up and what do you have to put on the line? And, you know, sometimes, like, for people who are working in the rank and file union like me, it's your job. And sometimes it's your reputation, and sometimes it's your political capital. So if you have access to resources, how are you going to, you know, expend some of that privilege that you have to pull someone up with you?
Mi nombre es Israel Peña. Yo soy un trabajador inmigrante que trabaja en la industria de la carpintería.
My name is Israel Peña, and I'm an immigrant working in carpentry.
En una marcha que tuvimos para que estábamos.
During a march we had where we were fighting for citizenship, for a pathway to citizenship. Unfortunately, I was fired from the company where I worked. They weren't interested in having me there as someone who knew how to stand up for their rights. And they let me go, and thanks to being part of the Essential Workers Network at Voces de la Frontera, in one of the institutes we created, we realized there was protection against such reprisals.
Nos dimos cuenta, esa protección se llama DALE, y es una protección que es...
That protection is called DALE. It defends against deportation, provides a work permit and social security, and allows you to get a driver's license.
Principalmente lo que debemos de perder es el miedo.
Primarily,
el miedo
what we need to lose is fear. The fear of all the abuses by employers who take advantage of our situation. Knowing we have the same obligations as any citizen in this country, but we don't have the same protections or rights. Immigrants in rural areas practically have no rights, and that's very sad. And because of that, unfortunately, people are very, very afraid.
Desgraciadamente, las personas tienen muchísimo miedo. Yo creo que eso es lo que necesitamos, perder el miedo.
We need to lose fear and know how to organize, because that's the only right we have as immigrants, and that holds real power, to organize. When something isn't right at work, coming together as a group, as co-workers, that's the only right I see that has more weight. So we can achieve things like what we achieved at the company where I worked, Countryside Cabinets. Thanks to the courage and valor we had, now more than 90 employees have received work permits through the DALE campaign.
El permiso de trabajo por en base a la campaña de DALE. Saben y se dan cuenta de la situación en la que nos encontramos cuando nos contratan.
They know the situation we're in when they hire us. But when it's no longer convenient for them to have us there, they remember that maybe we don't have the right documents to work. And that's how employers start discriminating. Saying things like, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go? I've heard that.
A decirte, como que tú a dónde te vas a ir. Eso yo lo he escuchado de compañeros que ahorita.
I have colleagues who are currently organizing in another company, and the employers themselves ask them, where were you? We're going to sue you because you're illegal. There are other stories of friends of mine who sometimes work in restaurants, and they're told they'll have their hours kept, that they won't be paid their told hours for the week, that they'll owe them. And then they end up getting paid for those hours at all. So there are many stories, not just one. There are many.
Pero queremos más, queremos ser reconocidos, queremos, no sé, un paso a la ciudadanía, residencia, ciudadanía, todo eso.
We want more. We want to be recognized. We want a pathway to citizenship, residency, all of that. We know there are many people who believe in us, who support us, who know that we also contribute here in this country. There are many people who discriminate against us or see us as, well, as if we don't have rights. They don't see us as people.
Nos ven como un objeto de labor, de trabajo.
They see us as objects of labor. But as I said, it's a very divided issue because there are other people who do recognize us. I think who should recognize us more is the government. The government should recognize us as workers, as an impact on the economy, and that we're here. I already have a life here, a family. I've been in the United States for over 16 years now, and here we are. Here we are supporting and working for the economy, of course, also for a better life.
Claro, para una vida mejor también para nuestras familias.
Also for our families, but working and making an impact, impacting the economy of this country.
Trabajando e impactando la economía de este país.
That was Israel Pena, an immigrant worker from Green Bay. You also heard from Stephanie Lohman, a nurse at Milwaukee's VA and vice president of the Milwaukee Nurses Chapter. They spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez and translated by Ale Guevara. You can hear more of this conversation at WUWM.com. In Milwaukee today, Voces de la Frontera is marching for immigrant workers' rights and will be holding a rally at the Fiserv Forum. Today marks the start of Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. It's a time of celebration, but also a time to recognize the histories of AAPI people. That includes a dark piece of Asian American history that happened in Milwaukee's Third Ward. Victor Ju is a senior lecturer in the Asian American Studies program at UW-Madison. He came on Lake Effect in 2022 to talk about what happened in the late 1880s.
In March of 1889, white rioters took to the street in the Third Ward District after the arrest of two Chinese laundrymen. And these Chinese laundrymen were arrested under suspicion of allegedly leading two young white girls into their laundry. But Victor, that wasn't entirely the whole story there. So what had happened that evening of March 6 in 1889?
You're right. There was so much that went on. It's a very complicated story. And to be honest with you, it's a bit of a sordid story, right? I mean, nobody's going to defend the idea of inappropriate behavior with minors. But the situation was you had two Chinese laundry persons in Milwaukee, Ha Ding, and they spelled it H-A-H-D-I-N-G, Ha Ding, and Sam Yip Ya, and they spelled Sam Yip Ya, Sam Yip, J-I-P, Ya, J-A, accused of inappropriate sexual relations with two white females. They eventually got sent to prison. They had trial. I think Sam Yip Ya did go to prison. And I looked up the prison records that you could find in the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. You know, Sam Yip Ya, he enters prison and he dies not long thereafter. But the important point is that all the Chinese were blamed. So there were two that were guilty. They got sent to prison. But all the Chinese in Milwaukee pretty much were targeted. Now, what happened in March of 1889 is that the news of this and the rumors that spread quickly ignited 4 days of rioting against Chinese laundries in Milwaukee. Chinese laundries were scattered throughout Milwaukee, pretty much. What you saw, especially as recorded in the newspapers, is that those who wanted to punish all the Chinese pretty much knew where those laundries were. I mean, they knew that they were in the Third Ward and other street locations. So they hunted down those laundries, threw rocks, broke windows, looked like they were going to start fires. And in one case, they actually hung a Chinese person in effigy. They took what would be a representation of a Chinese person, something that looked like a Chinese person would wear, that thing, that effigy, and sent a message, you know, this is going to be you. So what happened is there were about 60 Chinese in Milwaukee in 1889. It pretty much drove them out. To state it really fast again, complicated story, not the most uplifting of stories, but I think in the long run we can take, yes, it fit this history of if there was some misdoing, all Chinese got blamed for the misdoing of what, one or two. And that's a key historical fact to keep in mind, because that kind of thing happened a lot on the West Coast, in the Rocky Mountain areas. And for Wisconsin, Milwaukee has the unenviable distinction of being the one place during this period of anti-Chinese riot and violence, the one place that happened east of the Mississippi River. The others happened on the West Coast, Rocky Mountain areas, the Southwest. Milwaukee was the only place of anti-Chinese violence that happened east of the Mississippi.
That's very interesting. And I just also want to contextualize too within this time, just a few years prior to what had happened in Milwaukee on March in 1889, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 was passed, which prohibited any Chinese immigration to the United States. Essentially, if you were not a Chinese man who wasn't a merchant or in business, you weren't allowed to enter the United States, essentially. So Victor, just to help contextualize this, what was happening nationwide?
You asked that key question. Well, what's the big context for this thing that happened in Milwaukee? And you mentioned the national context. Let's really pull it back. You know, if we look at this era of anti-Chinese violence, we can say 1850s in California. So 1850s in California, moving on into the early decades of the 20th century, the 1900s. You have a number of instances, certainly on the West Coast in California, you have a common kind of behavior that could be called drivings out, where Chinese could be in Pasadena, for example, and call it a mob, call it a self-appointed committee, whatever, vigilantes. they would forcibly, in a disciplinary way, discipline Chinese by forcing them out of their homes, forcing them out of their houses and their laundries and their chop suey places. What we have by the 1880s is a combination of different kinds of aggression. We've got legal aggression through the laws. We have extra legal aggression, people thinking they're acting on behalf of the law, but they're not agents of the law. And you've just got plain old illegal aggression. And this aggression does take the form of various kinds of violence and aggressive acts towards Chinese. And by implication, after the 1900s, so much of this happened to other Asian-derived communities as well. Filipinos, Japanese, Koreans, South Asians. So when we look at 1889, Milwaukee, March of 1889, it was pretty much in the vortex moment of all of this Chinese exclusionary laws. During this period in the 1880s, a number of people felt they had to take the law into their own hands. Vigilantes, people who feel they are empowered because they think the law is not doing its job, they go about doing burnings, arson, shootings, killings. And I think the 1889 Milwaukee case was kind of like that. It was a case of white Milwaukeeans, white European Milwaukeeans, a lot of German Milwaukeeans, a lot of Polish Milwaukeeans, taking the law into their own hands in many ways. And I guess acting in the shadow of the Chinese exclusion system and feeling that these local Chinese in Milwaukee had to be disciplined, not just those directly accused of inappropriate behavior, but all the Chinese in Milwaukee.
It seems like this piece of Milwaukee's history isn't as well known in comparison to what happened in Los Angeles with those anti-Chinese riots. Why was Milwaukee such an outlier in this instance where it's not as well known? It seems to have been almost forgotten.
We've got variations of not knowing. It is generally unknown. And the efforts to try to make it known, they're so small. They're so far and in between. But to get to your other interesting question, what happened? What were the factors? Now, as far as what we remember and don't remember, it could be, is there such a thing as big embarrassment? Is there such a thing as a kind of, well, we really don't want to go there, or we really don't want to think about this too much? Because, you know, it involves what you suggested, various levels of complicity. It could be that that contributes to not knowing this history in general more, and certainly Milwaukee, 1889.
Well, Victor, I really appreciate you being here today on Lake Effect. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mallory.
Victor Ju is a senior lecturer in the Asian American Studies program at UW-Madison. He spoke with former Lake Effect producer Mallory Chang. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. The first episode is now available, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts for the next 10 weeks leading up to the Republican National Convention. Later in the show, we'll learn about a Wisconsin job posting that went viral for seeking people to eat cheese. But first, we'll learn about the best ways to avoid tick bites and Lyme disease. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsin is a hotspot for Lyme disease. Cases are rising as climate change and development alter how humans interact with the ticks that transmit this disease. The numbers reported each year have more than doubled in the last two decades. With tick season underway, tick checks are one of the most important ways you can prevent infection. WUWM's Lena Tran went to a lab at UW-Madison, where researchers are using a new tool to teach people how to do tick checks, mannequins.
Their names are Vanessa and Valerie. Both are tall brunettes, both dressed in sportswear, and both covered in dead black-legged ticks, the species that carries Lyme. Tila Jemsch is a research specialist at the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease, where scientists study ways to control ticks and prevent infection. Jemsch says the lab found the mannequins on Facebook Marketplace. At first, Vanessa was supposed to stand in for a human in a study on how ticks attach themselves to people. But soon they realized she could be useful as an educational tool. Now they have a whole family of mannequins.
So we've got child mannequins, we've got teenagers, we've even got preteen mannequins. That way, the event that we take it to, it's set up for who's going to be looking at the mannequins.
Ticks are notoriously tough to spot. A few years ago, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shared this photo of a poppy seed muffin. There were 5 ticks camouflaged among the seeds. The idea was show people how small they can be, encourage them to stay vigilant. The internet was grossed out. Later, the CDC tweeted an apology, saying they didn't mean to tick people off. But here's the thing. You're not very likely to run into ticks on a muffin. So when you're teaching the public how to spot the tiny arachnids, wouldn't it be better to show them what ticks look like on a person?
What ticks gonna look like? So this was an idea of how to get it in a context people are going to see. They're not going to see it in an image. They're not going to see it under a microscope lens. They're probably going to run into a tick on themselves. And what does that look like?
I went to the lab to learn how the plastic people are helping the researchers' outreach efforts and test out my own tick spotting skills.
Pretend this is your friend. She's okay. Just gone hiking and she's asked you to check her for ticks. Okay. So see you. I'll let you know, point out to me if you think you found one, and I'll let you know if you found it.
Okay, she is like a brunette in all black performance clothing. Here's one.
Yep.
On her, like, waist. That one was easy, which makes it feel like a trick, because it's a lot bigger. Is that one?
That is one.
Oh, it's on her arm.
The two mannequins are nearly identical, except Vanessa is wearing all black. She also has classic bangs. Valerie keeps her hair in a side part, and she's dressed in white. Wearing light-colored clothing is an important part of tick prevention. Ticks are much harder to detect on dark clothes.
It's hard to tell whether it's, like, a stain or if it's just an actual tick, which is really tough.
Adult ticks are the biggest and easiest to see. It's the baby nymphs that you really need to hunt for. Ticks don't carry the bacteria that causes Lyme on their own. They have to draw blood from wildlife hosts like deer or mice first. The bacteria spreads when an infected tick bites another animal, like a human. When a tick bites you, they can hang on for days. As they feed, they'll swell, coming close to tripling in size. That's why it's important to do a tick check soon after you spend time outdoors. If you find and remove ticks right away, there's less time for bacteria to spread.
Poor Vanessa. She's in trouble. She, like, went off trail for sure.
Oh, yeah. She definitely went hiking and some brush whacking. But, you know, she was out enjoying the day, and it's important that she's doing her tick check. So thank you for helping her.
Okay, here is a big one on her sock.
Yep.
And then is that one, or is it just, like, a piece of dirt? It's really hard to tell.
You tell me. What do you think?
Oh, I touched it. Maybe that's cheating. Okay, I think that's a piece of dirt.
Jemsch walks me over to Valerie, who's wearing the same outfit as Vanessa, but in white.
So this was another experiment that we did. We wanted to see, like, how black clothing and white clothing would affect them. Uh-huh. So she's got the exact same ticks that applied to her in the same spots. Uh-huh. So you did a really good job.
Jemsch says my performance on the test pretty much mirrors what they've learned from the demos at public events. People are better at finding ticks on white clothes than dark clothes. They're also better at spotting them on the upper body than the lower body. And people are much better at finding adult ticks than the young, tiny nymphs. Jemsch points to one that's the size of a sesame seed, which I missed on the black pair of tennis shoes. But they're easy to see on the white shoes.
I recognize these pants from Target.
They are exactly from Target, yes. Good eye.
I think I have the same ones as her.
Honestly, it was really cute. I went to go buy the mannequins' outfits, and then I came back a week later to purchase those in my size. Beautiful.
Well, now I'm like, I should have gotten the white ones,
yeah. I mean, cute, but yeah, it does really make you think, right?
when you bring them out to events and things like that, what is kind of the average success rate that you're getting?
So, great question. The average success rate when we took these out for the surveys, we had 16 ticks that were attached to them, and the average found was 7.
Whoa.
Yeah.
The researchers are using these results to come up with recommendations for more successful tick checks.
So first off, before I ever start my hike, I'm going to make sure that I tuck my pants into my socks, my shirt into my pants, so I don't have as much of a access to the skin for the ticks. It gives me more chances to spot them. And then when I'm done with my hike, or done with my hike or time outdoors, I start at my feet and then I work my way up. So I will check every little crevice. If I'm wearing shoes that have like flaps or folds into them, I also want to make sure I peel that back and look at that. I then will kind of make my way up my legs, and I'll just keep checking seams. I'll keep checking anything that looks even a little bit like a tick. If I've got a friend with me, I'll ask them to check my back, because I'm unlike our mannequins here, it's not quite as easy for me to see my back. I will then take my clothes and I'll put them into the dryer. So if I missed anything, the ticks will hopefully desiccate into the dryer. Showering afterwards helps too. I like to use insect repellent, so that also works with repelling ticks. So I'll make sure I use something like DEET or Picaridin, so that I can hopefully have less of them on me. And then the ones that I do find, with that tucking in and like methodic check from down up, can get anything else.
If you do find a tick on you, you can take a photo and send it to experts to identify.
Yeah. So we actually have a app called the Tick App that you can send in photos for identification of what the tick is. And by how big the tick is, people can actually tell how long it's been feeding. And depending on how long ticks have been attached, different pathogens transmit over different amounts of time. So there is kind of like a rate that you can tell of how big the tick is, roughly how long it was on you, and then if you should be worried about potentially a tick-borne pathogen.
What should people do at that point if they find a tick on them?
If it hasn't attached to you, you want to make sure that you remove it from yourself. If it has attached to you, it's really, really important actually that what you do is you take tweezers or some kind of instrument that you can pluck the tick, but you want to make sure that you get down as close to your skin as possible. They've got this it's called a hypostome. It's like a little straw, essentially, that they put into your skin. You want to get as close to that as possible. Pinch that and then pull up, twist a little bit. What you really want to make sure that you don't do is grab the tick by its body, because if you do that, you'll essentially cause them to regurgitate what's in their stomach into you, and that could potentially have pathogens. So you don't want to have them, you know, vomit or throw up pathogens into you. So you want to get down to as close to that straw as possible and then pull up.
As climate change makes our winters warmer, Wisconsin is seeing longer tick seasons. The spread of Lyme disease is also influenced by wildlife populations and land use changes that are pushing people and development further into tick territory. All of this means it's becoming more and more important to make tick checks a routine part of being outside.
Is to spend time doing the tick checks, really doing it in a methodical way, spending your time on it and making sure that you're really checking everything. I mean, you know, the tick checks, I like them. I still do them every single time I go on a walk. But now, having done this study, there's just things that I'm also making sure that I do, like really making sure I'm tucking clothes in and spending time. You know, it's not just something to kind of check off the list when I'm done hiking. It's something really important. I want to make sure that I can stay healthy and keep enjoying the outdoors. So spending time on it, being really diligent about it.
Wow, now I need to go exchange my pants for the white ones.
They are cute, too.
Yeah, they are.
That was researcher Tila Demsch, plus her lab assistants Vanessa and Valerie. For Lake Effect, I'm Lena Tran.
That was WUWM's Lena Tran at the Midwest Center of Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease. And a new season of Bubbler Talk starts tomorrow, but we still need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Then listen for new episodes starting in May, on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Did you know that eating cheese can be a job? We'll tell you all about it next on Lake Effect. on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. We make and eat a lot of cheese here in Wisconsin, but apparently you can get paid to do that. Last summer, UW-Madison publicized it was hiring a new crew of, quote, cheese tasters for UW-Madison Center for Dairy Research. And well, for obvious reasons, it went viral. It was talked about on CNN, The Today Show, and Business Insider. But WUWM's Mayan Silver wanted to uncover what it really takes to be a cheese taster and how the work is used. Here she is speaking with Brandon Prohaska, the sensory coordinator with the Center for Dairy Research.
So the job listing back in June said, the Center for Dairy Research is looking for individuals passionate about all types of food, but especially cheese, pizza, and other dairy products. Once hired, we will train you to become part of a group of expert tasters. These tasters are capable of, quote, verbally describing their sensory experience on the basis of appearance, texture, taste, and aroma. Okay, so Brandon, millions of people love pizza. What stands out from the crowd in applying to a job like this? What do you look for as the raw material, so to speak?
So, a lot of people reading about the job posting and talking about it on social media, you know, they're just kind of thinking, oh, we're tasting pizza. Do we say what we like, what we don't like? But we're almost thinking about this type of position as being like an analytical instrument where we're evaluating multiple samples throughout the day. We want results that are repeatable and also results that match up from person to person. So we each kind of have our own unique experience when we're tasting, say, a piece of pizza, for example. But we all want to be kind of on the same page and the same wavelength as the other members of the panel and be kind of approaching it in a very methodical and systematic way. So that's part of the challenge is, you know, we're looking for someone who kind of has that discipline and that, passion for evaluating products in that way.
So you don't want like five people saying, oh, this Swiss cheese tastes nutty, and another person saying, oh, it tastes fruity or something mm-hmm. like that.
Well, I mean, that does happen even after people are trained. There's kind of a phenomenon in which we all are a little bit unique in our genetics and our taste buds and things like that. So there are times when even highly trained people have some disagreements about each other. But the kind of thing that we're avoiding would be, for example, if you were raised outside of our panel, as everyone is, and you know, you might call something sour, and that might mean different things to different people. But when we're training people on the panel, for them, sour is specifically kind of the citrus or vinegary notes of an aroma. So some people, sour might be like spoiled milk or different things. So it's just like they're all using the same term, and that term means the same thing to everyone on the panel.
I see. So what's the point of all this in the first place? Yeah, fill me in on that.
Yeah. So on one hand, you know, we kind of mentioned people are like instruments in this case, where there's just certain things, you know, we can kind of approximate human smell and human taste with instruments, but it's a far cry from actually replicating that. So on one hand, that's kind of what we need is we need the human element of, you know, with any sort of food product, people are always going to be the ones tasting it and experiencing it. So we have to have that kind of direct comparison. Secondly, kind of the whole purpose of it is it's in our name, the Center for Dairy Research. We're doing lots of research into various ways to kind of help and assist the dairy industry. So we're thinking of a lot of different practical applications, things like how do we extend the shelf life of a product? How do we make something have an even better flavor? Or maybe there's a new technology coming out that's not quite you know, replicating the flavor people expect. And we're thinking about, well, how can we take that and make it closer to what it is? You know, those are all different types of examples of what we might be doing with the work of what we're tasting.
Don't tell me you're trying to make AI cheese.
No, it's very practical things. I think an easy to understand example would be in the cheese industry right now, it's more common or becoming more common to use something called concentrated milk, where you take some of the water out to begin with to give a better cheese yield. But sometimes the cheese itself doesn't have the same characteristics as if it's made the traditional way with the full amount of water already there. So in that case, we're saying, you know, we're being able to make it more economically, but we still want it to perform and function the same way, even though it's a slightly newer process.
How do you work in conjunction with cheese processors and with pizza makers and things like that? Like, mm-hmm. What's the relationship there?
Yeah. So it's anywhere from kind of semi-direct to completely direct, where at least in sensory, what we do is we can either, a client may come and ask, you know, hey, we're starting up a new plant or we're starting to make a new type of cheese. We need your descriptive panel to kind of analyze the flavor and the texture and the functional characteristics of this cheese to make sure that it either meets our customers' expectations or it's just like this other plant that we have, and, you know, give those results back directly. If in the case of research, it's kind of a semi-direct way where there's an overall project that we're looking to do that would support the entire kind of dairy industry from a wider perspective. So it could be, you know, like the example I gave earlier, where we're extending the shelf life or we're working with concentrated milks. You know, that's something that can help the entire industry, multiple producers. So it's anywhere kind of from that semi-direct way all the way up to we're one-on-one with a client and they want specific things that our sensory panel can help them with.
Is that one of the reasons that the UW Center for Dairy Research is doing these sensory panels and not the companies themselves, because you can have a broader perspective for a lot of people in the industry?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. So I like to describe it to people as the research keeps our panel busy every day. It's kind of like what pays the bills and keeps us working. In industry, these types of projects don't come up every day, and for them to kind of have a trained panel. So to give an example, the panel, we're either tasting and evaluating products every week, or if there's a week where we have nothing scheduled, we're practicing to do that. So the level of training and repetition and practice is so rigorous that unless a company is dedicated to say, this person's going to spend 10 hours a week doing this type of work, and in most cases I've seen in the industry, people are stretched pretty thin to begin with. And if they do sensory work internally, they're not able to dedicate that much time to keeping their people trained and practiced. So they typically will fall in either very large organizations or universities like us, where we're doing it every day. But yeah, and because of that, you know, because we are doing so much practice and repetition and seeing so many different things, we can give really good results that they can feel confident in when they see the report.
So why do you think this job posting kind of blew up?
It's a great question. And I don't know if anyone of us will ever have the answer as to like what the secret sauce was that made it kind of go viral. But I mean, I think, you know, cheese just has a kind of sort of comforting presence, and the thought of being paid to taste cheese all day. You know, there's a lot of different jokes made about it, you know, good or bad. But there was definitely some people very passionate and enthusiastic about, like, look at all the pizzas I've eaten. Here's all my, you know, Domino's receipts or whatever, and you should hire me. So, just something about it struck a chord with people.
How many applications did you get in, and how many people did you end up choosing?
So before, you know, the whole phenomenon went viral, we were setting out to hire about 5 people, and that didn't really change through the whole process, even though we got about 250 applicants. So part of it was we had a much larger pool to choose from. We've hired for this position before, and that's another thing, as people were interviewing, I kind of made them aware of is, you know, as people leave the panel, whether they're students who are graduating or they move on for whatever reason, there will continue to be new spots opening up on the panel. So even if they didn't get in this round where the competition was fierce, you know, every probably 3 to 6 months, we might hire another round of people because people are constantly moving on from the job and we train the next generation, so.
You mean you don't become a professional cheese taster for life?
Well, so that's one thing is we hired for this job before, but it was only recently where we started hiring non-students to do the job. It was about a year ago we hired our first round of people. And from our first round of hires, there is still one person who's still doing it a year in, and there's several people who are approaching a year now, and we're hoping that they'll stay with us for a really long time. We try to make it, you know, as fun and enjoyable and engaging as possible. And I'm sure 5 years from now, there'll be quite a few people who have been doing it for 5 years. So time will tell for sure.
How many people do you have rotating through these panels at once? Like,
so we tend to like to have around 20 to 25 people, whether they're fully trained or in the process of being trained at any given time. And part of what that is, you know, as people are, you know, they're busy or they're traveling or it's a holiday, we still have enough people who can be there any given week to get around 7 or 8 people kind of minimum on the panel for good results. Because a lot of what we do is for published research, we want to make sure it is, you know, good, solid science, repeatable data, and a good amount of data points so that we can feel confident in the results. And as I alluded to earlier, we're pretty much running every week, even holidays, Thanksgiving, week of Christmas. We're still in there doing panels because there's a lot of graduate students doing the research, and they pretty much stagger it where every week we've got something to do in the sensory panel.
Does anyone ever tell you, man, I cannot eat another piece of cheese? Like I'm...
You know, we've not really had anyone get too overwhelmed in that regard. Part of what we do with the process is we do go through a lot of cheese in a day, but most of what we do is we actually spit it out. It helps us from getting overly full, because when you get to that point, your taste buds kind of shut down, you don't really give good results, you kind of mentally get a little bit drained. Because even, you know, an hour and a half into our 3-hour session, we do normally take a break, because people probably think, oh, you're just eating cheese, what do you need a break for, whatever. But it is, I always give the example on pizzas, there's about 20 different attributes that we're evaluating, and we're on a pretty tight timeline where as one pizza's cooling down, another one's coming out of the oven, and we start evaluating that one. We're doing kind of two side by side. So it's maybe a little more rigorous than people expect. But once people are trained and we get in the hang of it, we get on a rhythm, and we can do about 6 pizzas start to finish in an hour.
And you gotta lay out what those characteristics are. Because when I eat a pizza, I'm like, okay, like good crust, good sauce, good cheese. But I'm not like, you know, getting into the nitty gritty of the cheese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I kind of think of it, we evaluate different attributes as the pizza cools down. So I've kind of got my mental list of what happens. Now, we do it on just kind of a plain crust with sauce, but everything about it that we're evaluating is the cheese specifically. So there's no really attributes about the crust or anything like that or the sauce. But we do things like the blister quantity, the little brown spots on the top of a cheese pizza, like how many are there, what size are they, what color are they. Then we look at if any cheese has flowed off the crust. We look at how well the cheese has melted, if it's melted completely, if there's some that's unmelted. We look at if there's free oil release. We look at if how much of a skin has kind of formed on the top of a pizza. We look then at the stretch, like how much does it stretch? How wide are the strands when you stretch it? And then finally, when it cools down enough, then we're doing flavor and texture attributes like the first chew hardness, the cohesiveness of the cheese, how chewy is the cheese? How much effort does it take? And then we get into flavor like salt and acid and buttery and milky and all these different attributes that we look at. So it's a long list.
Do people who go through this feel like they can't just sit and watch a Packer game and eat a slice of pizza anymore because they're going to be like overthinking every aspect of it?
You know, some people, I think, they have kind of an analytical mindset to begin with. So when people join the panel, they're like, I've kind of already done this before, and now I kind of have an excuse to be analytical when I'm tasting pizza and stuff. So I think kind of the opposite. Sometimes people get more of an appreciation for like what is truly a good cheese pizza. So they might find a brand, or they might learn how to make their own. Because some people think pizza has to be mozzarella, and we learn about things like blending in some Munster, blending in some provolone, and getting these more complex flavors and textures going on. So, and they might at the end of the day think of even better ways to make their pizzas at home and find good ways to enjoy them. The other thing that people will find is after you're tasting, you know, 20 different cheeses in a day, you find the one that you really like, and then you can go back at the end and have, you know, a full piece of that and enjoy it. So you're not wasting your stomach or your calories on anything that you don't really like as much. You find your favorite one.
All right. Brendan Prochazka of UW's Center for Dairy Research, thanks for joining me on Lake Effect.
It's my pleasure.
Brendan Prochazka is the sensory coordinator at UW-Madison Center for Dairy Research. He spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about plans for the future of one of the Milwaukee Public Museum's exhibits, Tribute to Survival, the rotating tribal display of a powwow. Plus, in the return of Bubbler Talk, we'll learn what happens to zoo animals when they die. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.